You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bunyan.
Welcome to the Catechism Hour with me, Brother Justin Bunyan of the Heralds of the Gospel, and today we are going to be talking about the Council of Ephesus. Now, if you remember from our last episode, we were speaking about the Council of Nicaea, and we talked a lot about the real essential element of councils within the church. The councils help to define the doctrines, the true doctrines, the true teachings of the church throughout the early church. What makes an ecumenical council ecumenical is that the Pope is the one who calls the council. Now, because of distances, because of the condition of the world at that time, many a time the Pope could not actually make it to the council. So he would send what was known as a legate, his man there, and he would preside, or he would be the man with the hammer. This becomes interesting in various forms, because some popes will exercise their ministry more efficaciously, others may not as much. But today, the Council of Ephesus is one that changes the course of many theological debates, unfortunately also plants the seeds of many future schisms. Theologically, it causes a lot of definition, but also with definition causes a lot of controversy. So the Council of Ephesus, for us Catholics, it is one of those councils which we laud. It didn't produce its own creed. It very much hung on to Nicaea. And you'll see that as we continue looking through various of these councils, that Nicaea is essential. It's really the capstone of the council system. There are many synods, but without the Pope, there is no councils. So don't forget, like when we had the Second Vatican Council, we had a Pope who brought it forward. The First Vatican Council, you had a Pope who brought it forward. And then there'll be many councils. Now, what makes it infallible is that the council, under the direction of the Pope, reiterates what has always been taught. And then the Pope uses his power ex cathedra to declare and define. The council on its own cannot declare something infallible. Okay, so that's why the Orthodox churches have such a difficulty, because they do not have the power of infallibility. And they themselves do acknowledge the first councils. So it's one of those really, really weird scenarios in which people get stuck into. So Council Ephesus. So it was a council which was called in the city called Ephesus, present day Selkirk in Turkey, in 431. And the one who called it, because of the mess that was going on, was the Roman Emperor Theodosius II. This is the third ecumenical council. Okay, so we got to remember this right at the beginning of it. Less than 100 years before the Christian Church was allowed to get out of its catacombs and become a something. So it's very much like a case of the church as an adolescent, trying to find its way, trying to define itself, trying to build itself and let itself expand into the form that it should have been, but because of persecution was unable to be. In this council, there was a true effort in trying to attain some form of consensus. A consensus in representing what it meant to be Christian. Remember, there are many forms, many churches, because of persecution, there was a lack of this cohesiveness, a unity of belief and understanding. So these councils are trying to bring everyone together and to be able to speak to a world that was predominantly pagan at this time, what it meant to be Christian. So in this council, they confirmed the Nicene Creed. Again, remember, it's from the Nicene Creed that these councils come out of. So it's based on this common declaration of faith that we build ourselves out. And they end up having to condemn the Patriarch of Constantinople, Nestorius. So what was Nestorius's problem? In our last episode, we talked about Arius. And Arius's problem was that he believed that Jesus Christ was man with godlike features. So he was a demigod. For the Greeks, that would have made a lot of sense. But Nestorius had another problem. He had a problem with the Virgin Mary. And so he ends up in his teachings and in his public utterances. He says the following. He held that the Virgin Mary should be called the Theotokos. Christos Tokos. The birth giver of Christ, but not the Theotokos. As Catholics, we use the term Theotokos, which means the birth giver of God. And this council was held in Ephesus from June to July of 431 in the Church of Mary in Ephesus. So let's quickly go through Nestorianism, and then we'll have a better idea why the church felt so strongly to call this council to condemn his teachings. So Nestorianism emphasizes the distinction between Christ's human and divine natures, and argued that Mary should be called the Christ-bearer, not the Theotokos. And that brought him into severe conflict with many of the church leaders, especially the most notable being Cyril, Patriarch of Alexandria, or Saint Cyril of Alexandria. Nestorius himself had requested the emperor to call the council, hoping that it would prove that he was the only one who was truly Orthodox. The council, in fact, condemned his teachings as heresy and declared Mary to be Theotokos, or the God-bearer. Nestorius had a personal issue with Cyril, and it became a personal dispute that had later wound itself into many other issues, and had later sought validation from Pope Celestine I, who authorized Cyril to request that Nestorius recant his position or face excommunication. So again, this is really important in the sense of what it meant to have popes. The Coptic Church today declares that the head of their church, Pope, they use the term Pope, is the head of their church, and that the Pope of Rome has no jurisdiction. While Cyril calls on the Pope of Rome for help in this situation. So it's the Pope of Rome who then tells Cyril to demand the recantation of Nestorius, who is the head of the church of the Greeks, or face excommunication. So that very clearly shows a superiority of the church of Rome above the other churches. Nestorius then will plead with the Eastern Roman Emperor Theodosius to call the council in which all grievances could be aired, hoping that it would vindicate him and condemn Cyril. And with that, the Pope. So we have present 250 bishops. The proceedings were anything but gentle and cordial. It is terrible. It is extremely heated. The controversy is very hot. And it's an atmosphere of confrontation and recriminations, and creates even greater tensions, not only between Cyril and Nestorius, but Cyril and Theodosius II. Nestorius was decisively outplayed by Cyril and removed from his see, and his teachings were officially anathematized. So not only was he excommunicated, not only was he declared heretic, but he was cursed. He was sent out. This starts what is known as the Nestorian Schism, of which churches that were supportive of Nestorius, especially in the Sassanid East, the Persian Empire outside the empire, were severed from the rest of Christendom and were known as Nestorian Christianity, or the Church of the East, and whose present representatives are as follows: the Assyrian Church of the East, the Ancient Church of the East, the Chaldean Syrian Church, the Chaldean Catholic Church, which came back into communion later on. Nestorius himself retired to a monastery and later recanted his own heresies. And this becomes a real issue throughout the history of these heresies, in which the heretic, or the heterarch, later in life perceives what he did wrong. And he recants. He comes back into communion. But others are more enthusiastic for his positions than he himself is, and they continue to push forward. So the leader of the church, leader of the schism, is Catholic, and the others go. So let's look at a more political twist on this, because don't forget, at this time, it's very, very difficult to separate the political side from that of the spiritual side. So firstly, the rivalry between Constantinople and Alexandria is arriving at its zenith. Now, don't forget, as we spoke about in our last episode, the four principal sees. Now, Antioch is really in its diminishment. It is no longer the city that it once was. It turns to more of a school, a city of schools, a city of learning. But in the political sphere, what have you, it kind of is falling back. Jerusalem, too, is falling back. So we end up with two major sees. We end up with Alexandria, which is still the financial center, and Constantinople, the capital. Alexandria is the it's a financial capital for many reasons, and it's hard for us many times to understand why. Let's do a few quick points to kind of adjust our minds to it, and then from there we can understand it better. Firstly, Alexandria is a port. It's at the delta of the Nile. What comes through it? Well, anything coming out of Egypt, coming up the Nile. Don't forget, the Nile flows into the Mediterranean. So it takes everything going from Ethiopia, from Somalia, all the way down to Kenya. All of that flows north. It all goes north. Second point, the empire functioned on grain. Believe it or not, wheat. That's why a lot of arguments are talking about now this new influx, people with celiac disease, being that there's something wrong with the wheat that we use today. Because anyone who comes from Mediterranean background, anyone who comes from a European background, ate wheat for millennia. Now, the empire depended on the wheat that came out of the Nile, because the Nile, though it doesn't rain, is incredibly fertile on the banks of the Nile. The mud that comes from the heart of Africa at the time of the floods packs up the Nile's sides, and it gives perfect ground for wheat harvesting. So money comes out of it. So it's an incredibly rich place. And one of the reasons for falls of the Roman Empire will be the loss of Egypt. When Egypt is lost, Constantinople will have the severe bind on it. It will have to find new places to get its goods from. And this will cause an amazing hurt on the empire. Just for us to understand that one point. Constantinople is the new Rome. They are an upstart city. They, though Constantine tried his best to bring in a lot of the old nobility that had lived in Rome, what have you, it still became an upstart community. The other element that kind of bothered the Romans, at least from the Western, though the barbarians run through, was the East was attaching itself much more to the Eastern finery. And this will become a common concern that the Roman virtue was lost and that it had become merely a Eastern fantasy. So the political controversy between Alexandria and Constantinople were based on this core element. And their heads come up with the patriarchs of Constantinople and of Alexandria going head to head. So what adds this? What emphasizes that is as much as the political competition contributed to an overall, let's say, quote unquote, climate of dissent, the controversy cannot be reduced merely to its political clashes. That's when you make the mistake. You look at it purely as something political, that is a mistake. Cyril of Alexandria viewed, quote unquote, an elevated intellectual argument about Christology. Cyril's problem was that it was the face of Christ. And this is something that the church and its Christology will adapt full-heartedly, whole hog, take the whole thing into the deposit of faith. It's the face of Christ. If the face of Christ is marred, if it's any way distorted, then the whole question of salvation is messed up. Again, I take a lot of these things from my classes, and with children, I love teaching kids, because kids, mostly kids that are involved, that are interested, that are followed, they get these things. And when you bring up Arianism, they're very quick to underline the very grave problem with only emphasizing on the divine. I had a little girl who just put her hand up. She says, but if Christ is not human and only divine, then he can't suffer. He can't feel what I go through. There is no connection. And if you get rid of Our Lady, then there is no human dimension. Then what is the incarnation? That was a 12-year-old. And that is really the core of the issue. So there is your issue. So as it said here, it goes, and this is from historian McLachlan, the validity and security of the simple Christian life. So again, that is the core of the issue. If we only emphasize on the divine, we end up with a real issue with the incarnate Christ. Christ, human and divine, the human that suffers, the human that goes through all these things, and the divine, which is the beatific vision, which is one with the Father. And that connection, though hard is not a good word, it's impossible for the human mind to understand. It brings us to the greater reality. So, in Alexandria, even within Constantinople, some supported the Roman Alexandrian position, and others supported the Nestorian position. So you have emperors, wives supporting one faction, the emperor supporting a different one. This ends up becoming this great chaos. And we can understand why it was so important to have this council to try to iron out these problems. So contention over Nestorius' teachings, which he developed during his studies in Antioch. This is why it got such a controversy. Antioch held a much more theological position that closely seemed to be closer to that of Nestorius. So it largely revolved around its and his rejection of the long-used term of Theotokos, the birth-giver of God, of the Virgin Mary. Shortly after his arrival in Constantinople, Nestorius became involved in disputes on two of the two theological factions. Nestorius's importance of being a representative of the Enochian tradition and to characterize him as the constant but not too clear exponent of long-standing Enochian dogmatic traditions. So he ends up pulling forward the Antiochian position, which, if you remember, Arius claimed to also present. So the school, the city of schools ends up becoming a real issue because you have too many academics who are trying to define things without, I wonder at times, much faith. Again, if I were to ask you how to define the Trinity, you would not be able to. You could give me simile, but pure definition would not be possible. Not being possible, you would say that humanly it's not possible, but if I'm a little bit of a rationalist or deconstructionalist, then I would say it's impossible. Therefore, there is no Trinity. I'd become a Unitarian Christian. I'm not sure about Christian belongs there, but anyway, let's leave it there. Nestorius was greatly surprised that what he had also been taught in Antioch, without any controversy, however, would prove to be so objectionable to Christians of Constantinople. Nestorius emphasized on the dual nature of Christ, trying to find a middle ground between those who emphasized the fact that in Christ, God had been born as a man, insisting on calling the Virgin Mary Theotokos, or the God-bearer, and others have rejected that title because God is eternal and having and could not have had been born. So Nestorius tried a middle position, which was the Christ bearer. But his proposal did not gain an acceptance from either side. Nestorius tried to answer a question considered unsolvable. Let's see what this question is. How could Jesus Christ, being part man, not be partially a sinner as well, since man is by definition a sinner since the fall? To solve that, he taught that Mary, mother of Jesus, gave birth to the incarnate Christ, not the divine Logos, as existed before Mary, indeed before time itself. The Logos occupied part of the human soul, the part of man that has stained during sin. But wouldn't the absence of a human soul make Jesus less human? Nestorius rejected this proposition also, answering that because the human soul was based on the archetype of the Logos, only to become polluted by the fall, Jesus was more human for having the Logos and not less consequently. Nestorius argued that the Virgin Mary should be called Christotokos, the Greek for the one who gave birth to Christ, and not Christotokos. He's trying to take two positions that are impossible to make, and the solution is found with the hypostatic union, that Christ is both God and man, and that Mary was immaculately conceived. So there is no sinner found in Christ. Christ isn't part sinner. He isn't part human, part not. God is simple. God doesn't have parts. God made man in his old image. Male and female, he made them. That's found in Genesis. God so deigned to come into our world. He came. So the person of Jesus Christ comes into time at the birth to the person of Mary. But at no point was he unattached from his divinity. It was always there. But he learned experimentally what it was to be human. And that way, not being sin, but taking on sin of humanity. He not sinning, but taking on sin. And for that reason, Mary, not having sin, allowed for a perfect place for him to be gestated. So Nestorius believed that no union between human and divine was possible. So he denies the hypostatic union. In such a union, a human and divine occurred. Nestorius believed that Christ could not truly be consubstantial with God and consubstantial with us, because he would grow, mature, suffer, and die, which Nestorius argued God could not, and also would possess the power of God that would separate him from being equal to humans. So his problem is the idea that God is master. He uses a syllogism of sorts in which he denies that God, who made all, can create the greatest miracle. It's a weird position to say, but it's very true. So that is something to look forward to and look on to. So a modern-day historian, before we go to our break, I'm just going to go to this last segment here, and then we're going to go to our break, and then we'll continue afterwards. So according to McGuigan, several mid-20th century accounts have tended to romanticize Nestorius in opposition to his view. He asserts that Nestorius was no less dogmatic, uncompromising than Cyril, and that he was fully just as prepared to use political and canonical powers on Cyril and all the rest of them as he was himself. So it wasn't as though he was some idealistic individual who was a good soul that got beaten up by the system. He was using the system as much as the others, and just that he was beaten at his own game. So that's really where we need to look at. Nestorius's opponents charged him with detaching Christ's divinity and humanity into two persons existing in one body. And thereby, he denied the incarnation. Again, children, very quick at deceiving that, they're pulling that apart. They really pull it apart really quickly, and you start getting their questions like, no, this is wrong because of this and that and the other thing. But something to keep in mind as we go into our break is, how do this apply to me? How do I look at the person of Christ? How do I look at the face of Christ within my life? Do I look at him as one with us? Do I look at him as Jesus Christ, you know, divine, human, 100% of both, always in my life? Or do I look at it as Jesus Christ is very human and I forget his divinity? Or do I look at him as only divine and not human at all? So as we go into our break, let's ask ourselves that big question. And with that, we will come back in a few moments' time.
Jesus, talk to us.
You are listening to the Catechism Hour, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. To contact us, you can tweet us at Radio Maria Can or email catechismhour@radiomaria.ca.
Welcome back. So after you had a few moments to think about that great question, which is how does it affect me in my life? Because it's history really becomes rich when we apply it to our lives. And this is the Catechism Hour. This is how we learn our faith. We don't understand how other people have fallen, have made mistakes. Then when we too make a mistake, we won't find precedence in history. So that being placed, let us continue. There's a famous church historian. His name is Eusebius. He later becomes a bishop in the neighboring diocese close to Constantinople, known as Dorylaeum. And he was the first one to accuse Nestorius of heresy. But of course, the most powerful opponent of Cyril will be, the most powerful opponent to Nestorius is Cyril. Because he is what is known as the Pope of Alexandria. He is the leader of the Church of Egypt, of Somalia, of all that whole area, Libya, of North Africa. And at that time, that area was a major hub of Christianity. So what's Cyril's primary condemnation? His primary one is he says Nestorianism splits Jesus in half and denies that he is both human and divine. See, in Orthodox Christianity, Jesus is God and man hypostatically united. So it's two whole persons held together. In Nestorianism, it's two halves. We have halves. We don't have wholes. So Cyril then appeals to the Pope, Celestine II, charging Nestorius with heresy. The Pope agrees and gave Cyril the authority to serve notice to Nestorius to recant his views within 10 days or be excommunicated. But before acting on the Pope's commission, Cyril convened a synod. So a synod is a gathering of priests and bishops under a metropolitan's authority. So that's what a synod is. Which condemned Nestorianus as well. Cyril then sent four suffragette bishops to deliver both the Pope's commission as well as a synodal letter of the Egyptian bishops. Cyril sent a letter to Nestorius known as the third epistle of St. Cyril to Nestorius. Third, which means there were two others. This epistle drew heavily on the established constitutions by the doctors and fathers of the faith. Again, this is something we do as Christians. We always go back and base ourselves on a tradition. And that tradition is constantly evolving, but constantly growing, but never in denial of, never in contradiction of. And contained the most famous article of Alexandrian Orthodoxy, which is known as the 12 anathemas of St. Cyril. In these anathemas, Cyril excommunicated anyone who followed the teachings of Nestorius. For example, quote, anyone who dares to deny the Virgin Mary the title of Theotokos is anathema. Nestorius, however, still would not repent. It's pointed out that the representatives of the Enochian tradition, such as John of Antioch, Theodoric, Andrew of Salamata, were able to recognize the point of argument of Christ's integrity and conceded the ill-advised nature of Nestorius' immobility. So other guys who will later get excommunicated perceived that Nestorius was being a little bit stuck in the mud, and they were kind of moving towards a position of saying, you know, Nestorius, you're in the wrong spot. Concerned with potential negative result of a council, they argued to Nestorius to yield and accept the title of Theotokos when referring to the Virgin Mary. They saw that it wasn't going to be good. Nestorius was a little bit hard-headed and he refuses to move. And then in turn, what happens? Well, we see what happens. So John of Antioch He wrote to Nestorius and urged him to submit to the Pope's judgment and ceasing stirring up controversy over a word that he disliked. He didn't like the term Theotokos, but which couldn't be interpreted as having an Orthodox meaning, especially in light of the fact that many saints and doctors of the church had already sanctioned the word by using it themselves. Again, that element within the church, which we always use, the continuousness of history, it had already been used. It had already been used by many others in the past. Therefore, you're out of line. It's funny, whenever we believe we are the only one right, is usually the point that we're either mad or wrong, which sometimes matches. So John writes him to say, writes in a story, he says, don't lose your head. 10 days. It will not take you 24 hours to give the needed answer. Ask advice of men you trust. Ask them to tell you the facts, not just what you want or think you will please you. You have the whole of the East against you, as well as Egypt. So that's someone who later gets condemned himself as a heretic. But Nestorius was stuck. He was in a position where he felt he had no way out, but he was going to fight it out. So, 19th of November, Nestorius, anticipating the ultimatum which was about to be delivered, convinced the emperor to summon a general council, which Nestorius hoped to convict Cyril of heresy, and thereby vindicating himself. The council was called. Each bishop was to bring only his most eminent suffragants. So, what's a suffragant? Let's use, for example, the Archdiocese of Toronto. So the Archbishop of Toronto is the metropolitan of his ecclesiastical province. His suffragants would be the bishops who are in that province under him. So let's look at Toronto. Toronto, you have the Diocese of Hamilton, Diocese of London, the Diocese of St. Catharines, and the Diocese of Thunder Bay. Now, let's say you have, of these, you have a few that are very well known as doctors of canon law, of moral theology. Let's say before they became bishops, they were highly accredited in those fields. So then the Archbishop Cardinal of Toronto would take along one or two of those along with his group to represent his ecclesiastical province. The idea was that they didn't bring everybody because there just wasn't accommodations for everyone. So the date set by the emperor for the opening of the council was Pentecost, which was that year, the 7th of June, 431. Problems. The calling of this council was vague, and being vague had many interpretations by many bishops, in particular the vastness of John of Antioch's ecclesiastical territory required a lengthy period to notify and gather his delegates. He had a huge area. Antioch was one of those huge zones, don't forget. Because of an overland trip from Antioch to Ephesus was long and arduous, John composed his delegation of his metropolitan bishops, who were restricted to bring no more than two suffragans each. By doing so, he minimalized the number who would have to travel to Ephesus. Neither of the emperors attended the council. Theodosius appointed Count Candida to head the imperial palace guard, to represent him, to supervise the proceedings of the council, and to keep good order in the city of Ephesus. Don't forget, at that time, I think even till today, the peoples of the East tend to be a little bit rowdy. And they were ready for that. Bishops were rowdy too. The famous story, which now a lot of historians don't believe because the bishops don't do that, I tend to give belief to it because there are many a story of people being stoned and punched, and so the case of Nicholas punching Arius. And we have full-out fights in Ephesus, so it's normal. It's what happened. So the council is called in favor of Nestorius. And Theodosius is hoping that the whole council will just take on the Christological controversy and will get over with it quickly. The mistake that Nestorius made was not doing his homework on where the locations were going to be, because Ephesus, in the Church of Our Lady, who lived in Ephesus? Our Lady lived in Ephesus. The devotion to Mary, Mother of God, was probably centered greatest in Ephesus. The tradition of the Stations of the Cross come out of Ephesus, a devotion that Our Lady brought from Jerusalem. Mary lived there. John lived there. So there was deep roots of a Marian devotion. And the Bishop Menon, who was Bishop of Ephesus, was a strict Cyrillian Orthodox bishop. So you might say you may come with a strong hand, but the grassroots of this whole council are strictly against you. So Cyril brings with him 50 bishops, arriving a few days before Pentecost. Unfortunately, from the West, at this point, it's already chaotic. So the West does not get fully represented. And this becomes an issue going forward with the barbarian invasions. It becomes more and more difficult for the bishops to go east. The Palestinian delegation of 16 bishops. And you see a lot of them are lining up with Cyril. So it's really a problem. Right from the beginning, they set the council up and they called to matter the issue. And with the Cyrillian side being a majority, they call Nestorius to council. And he refuses the summons. That's his first big mistake. Because by not going into the summons, not going into the council, he made the mistake of being a stick in the mud. And the whole thing, it just starts to get really complicated. The Denokians, they arrive late. They arrive 5 days late. And they were told that the council hadn't begun without him, and they had already ratified Celestine's anathemas. And this is where the council goes bonkers. But we don't have time to go through the whole sessions of it. But I'm going to go straight to the end of it, the council. The council ends with the denunciation of Nestorius' teachings as erroneous, a decree that Jesus was one person, and the Greek word for that is hypostasis, and not two separate persons, yet possessing both a human and divine nature. We don't have multiple persons running around. The Virgin Mary was to be called Theotokos in the Greek, which means God-bearer, the one who gave birth to God. The council declared that, quote, unlawful for any man to bring forth or to write or to compose a different faith as rival to what is established by the Holy Fathers, established and assembled by the Holy Ghost in Nicaea. Again, remember I said before, Nicaea is the capstone. Everything refers back to Nicaea. So when this is off subject, but when John Calvin, hundreds of years later, will begin with his problems, he's going to kind of scrape himself back until he reaches Nicaea, because he realizes that if he's going to attack the person of the church, Nicaea is where his writings will have to start. So and then it quotes the Nicene Creed as adapted to the First Council of Nicaea in 325, not as added and modified at the First Council of Constantinople in 381. So we have this issue of people going back to Nicaea 1 to build off of it. And this becomes a common occurrence. So in the condemnation of Nestorius, which is done, and that's where the Nestorian heresy is born. It also contains and also condemns Pelagianism and rejected pre-Millerianism in favor of amillennialism. That's a real complex element. And it's funny because if you look at pre-Millerianism, you end up with a whole batch of great saints who were fathers and doctors of the faith, but whose points the church didn't look very well upon. And this is something that we batted around a bit, and we have this outside point, which is, so I'll just give you an example. Premillennialism are known by Lactantius, Origen, Tertullian, Papus, Irenaeus, and St. Justin Martyr. Amillennialism, we end up with Clement of Alexandria, Chrysostom, Jerome, and Augustine of Hippo. And they're all in heaven, and they can still continue having their debates. So, quote, Augustine's explanation about the church doctrine when it's adapted as definite explanation of the millennium by the Council of the Ephesus in 431. So it's a whole question of the use of the 1,000 years, which is found in Revelations. And until today, most Protestant groups still have an issue with this, and they still bring it up. It's a figurative phase. It's really not worthwhile for us to go through at this moment. So we need to understand this going forward, particularly in the person of Christ, understanding who Jesus is, how he suffered for us. He suffered for us in the truest form of the word. Though as a human, he would not have been able to suffer as much as he did. It was as though his divinity sustained his humanity to allow him to receive the full punishment for the sins of humanity. But his humanity received it. So we need to understand that side. So I want to take a quote here from the Council of Ephesus. This is understanding of the sacraments of the church and also the understanding the end of our existence eschatologically. And that also which the Holy Church uniformly does in the whole world with regard to those who are baptized, we do not observe with indifferent respect. Since whether children or youths come to the sacrament of regeneration, they do not approach the fountain of life before the unclean spirit is driven out and driven away from them by the exorcisms and the breathing on them by the priests, so that then is truly manifest how the prince of this world is set forth in John 12:31, how the strong man is first bound, Matthew 12:29, and therefore the vessels are been plundered, and that's Mark 3:27, having been transferred the possession of the victor who leads captivity captive, and that's Ephesus 4:8, and gives the gifts to man. So if you can see that, I'm going to quote from Augustine's work, which is that lines up with this very well. Augustine, of course, would have been pro-Ephesus. The Lord Jesus Christ himself says, no man can enter a strong man's house and spoil his goods except he first bind the strong man. Means that the strong man being the devil, because he has the power to take captive the human race, meaning by his goods, which he has taken, those who have been held by the devil, various sins and iniquities. But where to become believers in himself? It was then for the binding of the strong one that the apostle saw in the apocalypse, quote, an angel coming down from heaven, taking the keys of the abyss and chain on his hand. He laying hold, and he says, on the dragon, the old serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, that is, bridled and restrained his power so that he could not seduce and gain possession of the free. So the eight canons of Ephesus are the following. The 1 to 5 condemn Nestorius and his followers as heretics. Canon 6 decreed deposition of clerical office or excommunication of those who did not accept the council's decrees. Canon 9 condemned any departure from the creed established in the First Council of Nicaea, in particular in its, by a certain priest who had been doing so. And Council 8 condemned interference by the Bishop of Antioch in the affairs of the church in Cyprus, and decreed generally that no bishop was to assume control of any province which was not hereto, and from the very beginning had been under his hand or his predecessors, lest the canons of the church be transgressed. So that's kind of what Ephesus is about. I recommend that you do dig in a little deeper. Ephesus is really quite fabulous, quite amazing council. And it causes this amazing and sad, I might say, rupture within the church But the person of Christ is been redefined. And from this point forward, the definition of Christ being clear, the hypostatic union has been set in council, and we move forward. And the West will continue to develop this. It's funny to say, but the East-West problems, the West doesn't have half the issues that the East does. So with that said, may God bless you. Looking forward to our next episode. If you have any questions, you can contact through the Radio Maria website, through Facebook, any which way through the various means of social communications. May God bless you, and God bless.
You have been listening to the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bonnion, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.